Good morning. I do not have a joke for you this morning. I figured that the two from last week were bad enough that you're still groaning this week. A long time back, way back, I mean over 20 years ago, I remember I was working at Meijer, the grocery store. While I was in college, I was a clerk. First, when I first started working there, and a gentleman who had obviously moved here from foreign lands, he came up to ask me a question. I don't remember anything about what it was that he came up to ask me, but it led to a short conversation. In the conversation, he motioned to two women who were a few feet off, a few yards away, and he referred to them as his wives. Wives, plural. I remember smiling at him as though he were pulling my leg. He asked me why, and I said, well, they can't both be your wife. He insisted that they could. I told him that the law here in the U.S. only permits one spouse per person. He insisted that they were both his wives and would always be. By the way, I found out that I was mistaken in that. The law in the United States allows that when people move here from foreign countries and have more than one wife, they are both considered their wife, just not for tax purposes. They have to file differently on taxes. But I was mistaken on that. We had a bit more of a conversation before we bid each other good day. A few years later, in about 2002, I was having a theological discussion with some friends of mine in which I asked about something which was probably soon in coming. I said, what do you do when a family has just moved to town? And they come to the church and they ask to join the church. And they inform you that they are recent converts to Christianity and that they used to be Muslim or some other religion that permits more than one wife. And the man says, yes, we'd like to join your church. This is me and my three wives and all of our children. And I'll tell you something, in this theological discussion, there was a lot of, because what would you do in that situation where someone comes? There was so much discussion and so much disagreement. It went all the way from, at one side, one person said, well, he's going to have to divorce all except for his first wife. And the other end of the spectrum, somebody said, wow, what a gigantic boon for the youth group. And everything in between. Now, I posted on Facebook a couple of days ago that I was going to be preaching today here on polygamy and polyandry. And one of my friends says, you have a big problem with that in Marion? And I said, best to address the issue while you don't have a problem with it. Let me be very clear, folks. If it's not already in the works, there will soon be lawsuits against states who say that you can only have one spouse. Because there are people who have immigrated here from other countries or from Utah and have more than one spouse. And they're going to say, excuse me, how can you tell me I can only have one spouse when you've thrown out virtually every other law about how marriage is dictated from the state? They're going to say, you said a man can marry a man and a woman can marry a woman, so how dare you say that when my religion says I can have two wives, how can you say that I can't? And there is not a legal leg that they will have to stand on. And very soon, folks, this is going to be reality among us, and it's going to be situations in which we address. And furthermore, another friend of mine responded to his somewhat tongue-in-cheek comment where he said, you have a big problem with that, do you? In your town? this other person who responded is a psychological counselor. And she counsels primarily Christians. And she says she deals with way more than you would think people who have open marriages and who are practicing having more than one spouse, even when it is not lawful. I myself know someone who grew up very conservative in churches and went off the deep end for a while and was living with another couple in a polygamous relationship. It may not have been legal, but it was going on. So this is maybe it may seem like something that is far-fetched, but probably best something to address when you don't have someone asking to do their polygamous wedding the next Saturday. I have a great volunteer secretary. I told her what the topic was today, and she had no idea what to do to give me for the picture on the front of your bulletin, and she came up with this, and I just said, perfect. That is absolutely perfect for today. She just is great at what she does. The only thing, by the way, in our discussion, me and my friends, about the theological issue, the only thing that could be absolutely certainly agreed upon was that this family, this hypothetical family that was going to join a church, the only thing all of us agreed upon was that they couldn't be elders or deacons. That's the only thing, you see, that's the only place in the New Testament where teaching on polygamy is absolutely and unequivocally addressed and forbidden. Turn with me, if you would, to Titus chapter 1. Titus chapter 1, verses 5 through the first part of 7. It says, "This is why I left you in Crete, so that you might put what remained into order, and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. If anyone is above reproach, the husband of one wife, and his children are believers and not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination. For an overseer, as God's steward, must be above reproach." An extremely similar instruction is given in 1 Timothy chapter 3, which also includes the same command for male deacons, that they cannot have more than one wife. But this is the only clear-cut instruction in the New Testament about the practice of polygamy. To be sure, there is plenty that is said about adultery in the New Testament, and it does specifically rule out polyandry, which is the practice of a woman having more than one husband. Believe it or not, that one is said you can't do. But in the New Testament, it does not specifically address the issue of polygamy, the practice of a husband having more than one wife. So the question comes, if the New Testament does not specifically forbid polygamy, and the Old Testament would at least seemingly endorse polygamy, then why is it that we in the Western Christian tradition forbid it? This is an issue that we're probably going to have to face in the not too distant future, with the walls of everything about marriage crumbling down around us. If it isn't forbidden in the New Testament and practiced on a regular basis in the Old Testament by people like David, whom God said was a man after his own heart, which seems to be giving God's endorsement, then why is it not allowed in the vast majority of Christianity, and why would it be specifically ruled out for leaders in the church? Now, I've said that the Old Testament seemed to endorse polygamy, but did it really? Let's take a look back at some instances of it and where it would seem at first that God even said for it to be so. When David had taken Bathsheba, stolen her actually, by murdering her husband after David had committed adultery with his wife, This was, it specifically says, displeasing to God. And he sent Nathan the prophet to call David out on it and to condemn it as sin. One of the things that the passage seems to say is that God gave David a whole bunch of wives and would have given him even more if David had asked him, so that he shouldn't have been so evil as to kill a man, commit adultery with his wife, and take her as his own. 2 Samuel chapter 12, verses 7 through 9 says, Nathan said to David, "You are the man." This is after he's told him the story about the little ewe lamb and the rich guy who had many. He says, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you out of the hand of Saul, and I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your arms, and gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if this were too little, I would add to you as much more. Why have you despised the word of the Lord to do what is evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the Ammonites." In reality, what this is saying is that God had made David king. In doing so, in God making David king, David had inherited everything that Saul, the former king, had, which included his wives. But this practice of the king inheriting the former king's wives, is not to be found anywhere in the law of God. And quite frankly, it's a little weird, because Saul was David's father-in-law, and one of Saul's wives had been the mother of David's first wife. So that's kind of a little weird situation going on there. But it's not anywhere, that practice is nowhere to be found in instruction in the Old Testament. It was merely a habit, a tradition of the people. Which begs the question, since Saul was the first king of Israel, and there wasn't any precedence before this, for this evil practice, where had they learned this little trick? It could only have been from the nations around them, whom they wanted to emulate in having a king in the first place. The evil nations around them had originated this practice, and they were copying it without the consent of God. It could not have been God who gave David many wives as a way of saying that he endorsed the practice and thought it was good, because we know that God had specifically forbidden kings to take many wives centuries earlier in the Mosaic Law. God knew that they would start doing dumb things like this, like having lots of wives, like having lots of gold, things of that nature. He knew that they would be greedy and stupid about their possessions and their place in the world. So he gave them the following verse to help keep them straight about it. Turn with me to the Old Testament Mosaic Law in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 15 through 17. It says, "You may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Only he must not acquire for himself, only he must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again, and he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold." God told him not to be doing that. So it is not an endorsement from God that he was. So guess what? David Solomon. They're directly sinning against God. So I would argue against them sinning against their first wife by taking many wives. And why is the reason that they were forbidden to do this? It tells us the reason. It says because their hearts would turn. Turn from whom? From God, for starters, and from the relationship of marriage that He had installed. And it's not like they could claim ignorance of this. This is two little verses in the Mosaic Code. They could say, oh, you know what? I forgot about that. I forgot that it said I wasn't supposed to be taking many wives. Because as part of the law, in fact, in the next two verses, God had made it the rule that the kings had to personally write down for themselves a copy of this law and read it over and over and over again throughout the years. In verses 18 and 19 it says, "And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them." God wanted them to know the law, so they had to write out their own copy. Can you imagine if you decided, you know, I'd like to have a Bible, a new Bible. I think I'll just run down to the gospel bookstore and buy myself a new Bible. And God says, no, wait, time out. Here's an old copy. You just write yourself a copy. I think you'd know it a little bit better that way. So why did God tolerate this practice? Why is it we see so many people in the Old Testament, so many men who have multiple wives? Why did God tolerate it? Why didn't God come down and smite the kings and all the other people who had taken up this practice of having more than one wife? Well, sometimes I think that the best punishment for a person is making them live with the mistakes that they've made. In this case, they literally had to live with the mistakes that they had made. I mean, can you imagine how this must have been for Jacob? His two wives were sisters who hated each other's guts. Imagine the domestic tranquility that he got to live with in that situation. Then they made him take their servants as concubines, and when they had children, when those concubines had children, his wives hated them also. Can you imagine how life was for Jacob? I'm thinking Jacob spent a lot of time in the garage working on things. Because, in fact, over and over again, throughout the Old Testament, whenever we see the details of the lives of men who have taken more than one wife in their lives, we see strife, bitterness, and hatred. This is only natural. Because one wife is what God designed for one man. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. And it just strikes me also that in most of these cases, not so much with Jacob, but in most of these cases where a man takes more than one wife, do you know what he also gets? More than one mother-in-law. And if that's not punishment, God tolerated a situation that he never designed and he never endorsed because he knew that people were sinful and weak. He never said it was good or even okay, but he tolerated it at best because he knew that people were hard of heart. Ladies and gentlemen, I am hard of heart, you are hard of heart, everyone is hard of heart. That's why we sin. It is just as Jesus said when he was speaking concerning marriage in Matthew 19, verses 4 through 8. He answered, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let man not separate.' They said to him, 'Why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and send her away?' He said to them, 'Because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed.'" They said, "Command." He said, "Allowed you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so." This is why God tolerated polygamy in the Old Testament. Not because he designed it to be so, not because he desired it to be so, but he knew that people make mistakes. And so he tolerated them doing something that was not in his heart. Now, I am a big restoration movement guy. And one of the things that we push is that if the Bible does not specifically talk about it, then neither do we. And even though I will show that the Bible does speak fairly specifically on this, I will grant that hypothetical argument. But God does address the mindset as well when he's talking to former pagans who have pointed out that we are not under the Old Testament law and that we should be able to do however we want. They're standing there going, "But we're Christians. We're not Old Testament law. All that stuff doesn't apply to us. We're saved by grace, and so these things shouldn't be forbidden. We should be able to live as we please." In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 12 through 17, it says, "All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be dominated by anything. Food is meant for the stomach, and the stomach for food." That's their argument. "And God will destroy both one and the other. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And God raised the Lord, and will also raise us up by his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For as it is written, the two will become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with him." This is where we get into the real spiritual side of this argument. God declared that when a man and a woman have sex, there is a bond which is more than just physical. There is a spiritual bond there created by that act, even in such a base way as when a man has sex with a prostitute. This bond is created. And I'm not going to go into great detail, but there is much to be said that when he then joins with another woman, or she with another man, then the bond between the first two is destroyed. It is broken in favor of the new bond. The concept of having multiple spouses is the concept of a cycle, a constant cycle of creating and then breaking spiritual bonds. This can be a devastating thing when it happens one time, as in divorce and remarriage, but that is something that can heal because a new bond is created and they can go on from there. But how can a person think that they could do this on a constant basis and there would not be serious spiritual and mental ramifications? When someone just continually, day after day after day, creates and destroys a spiritual bond between them and someone else, that is not something that is just going to happen without negative feedback. A man and a woman cannot and will not form the kind of spiritual bond that God intended for us if one of them is constantly breaking it and forming other bonds with other people. Having this happen all the time will never, ever bring a person to marital happiness. People think that if we could just throw off all these rules and all these laws, then we'd be happy. Nothing could be further from the truth. God designed us, and He designed us to be happy with each other and with Him. And when we throw out all of that and we destroy it in favor of other things, and this applies not just to people who think they can have more than one wife, but to people who have never married and think that they can just go from bed to bed to bed to bed, there will never be happiness formed in that way. Lastly, I will address the first words on this subject. Genesis chapter 2, verses 23 through 25. Then the man said, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." This is the final and first word on the topic. This is the bedrock foundation. God had created man and put him over all of creation, but nothing suitable as a partner was found for him. So God took from his own flesh and created the perfect counterpart. Yes, that's right. Gentlemen, she is your perfect counterpart. Adam himself exclaims, "At last." Because he knew that his search was over. He was not made multiple wives, that they should be another part of his domain to rule over. He was made a singular partner to complete him in an exclusive, permanent, God-sealed relationship. It was never God's intention that he would be in a relationship between one and many, but between one and one. The first we see of someone breaking this as the set way of things is a murderer several generations later who decides that he needs two wives. Someone who obviously had many issues with the designs that God had for life. God desires deep happiness for us in our relationships, both with Him and with each other. The concept of having more than one spouse at a time is unthinkable in the plan that He has for us. Unfortunately, the world is full of greed and strife, and the hatred of the will of God. It's my prediction that this will become an issue in the courts within a few years, if not sooner. Let us, you and I, live as examples of the wonderful things God has in mind for us, so that we can be lights shining in the darkness for Him. People despise what God has for us. Mostly that's because we mess it up. We've all sinned. We've all fallen. We've all done bad things. But as the world sinks deeper and deeper into darkness, we need to strive to live as light, shining for God in the darkness, so that they can see in us the goodness that He has in mind for us. We've all sinned. Me, you, the person next to you. The way away from that sin is the forgiveness that comes through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross, and only through that. But it can take away anything that you've done. If you've not had that experience yet, if you have not given yourselves to Jesus Christ, been immersed with Him for the forgiveness of your sins, and risen as a new person, I invite you to do that today. Please stand as we sing.